Hello and welcome to Dinesh Guard YouTube podcast show, powered by businessabc.net and citiesabc.com. I want to start with a quote by Aristotle: "Knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom." So today I'm quite excited to welcome to my series one of the biggest AI minds and actually philosopher in the world, and one of the most influential personalities when it comes to research, when it comes to defining the journey of humanity, and as well looking at solutions between utopia and dystopia, and a lot of different areas from computational neuroscience, logic, artificial intelligence, philosophy. So I welcome to my series Nick Bostrom, that is a Swedish-born philosopher with a background in theoretical physics, computational neuroscience, logic, and artificial intelligence, along with philosophy. Nick Bostrom is known for his work on existential risk, the anthropic principle, human enhancement, ethics, whole brain emulation, superintelligence risks, and the reversal test. Nick Bostrom is a professor at the Oxford University. Nick is the author of more than 200 publications, and some highlights are Anthropic Bias, Global Catastrophic Risks, it was written in 2008, Human Enhancement, 2009, Superintelligence Paths, Dangers, Strategies, 2014, which became a New York Times bestseller and sparked a global conversation about the future of AI. And the most recent book, which is launched in 2024, in May, Deep Utopia: Life and Meaning in a Solved World. Nick Bostrom's academic work has been translated in more than 30 languages, and he is the world's most cited philosopher, age 50 or under. He is a repeat main stage TED speaker. He has been interviewed more than 1,000 times by various media, including some of the top publications in the planet. He has been on Foreign Policy Top 100 Global Thinkers list twice and was included in Prospect's World Thinkers list, the youngest person in the top 15. Nick's work has pioneered some of the ideas that frame current thinking about humanity's future: the simulation argument, the vulnerable world hypothesis, the Nihilist's curse, and much other topics.
As a graduate student,
Nick has also tried a stint in the stand-up comedy in the London circuit. About superintelligence in particular, I want to highlight that Nick Bostrom's concept of superintelligence, outlined in 2014 and now more relevant than ever, 10 years before time, is a bestseller that delves into the potential development of artificial intelligence, AGI, and its implications. So Nick Bostrom has been ahead of the time, exploring various pathways to achieving superintelligence, including whole brain emulation and AGI, highlighting the transformative power such entities could wield. It distinguishes between final goals and instrumental goals, arguing that while certain objectives may converse across intelligent agents, the combination of any level of intelligence with diverse final goals could lead to unforeseen consequences. It's my honor to welcome to this series. So today I'm quite excited to welcome to my guest Nick Bostrom, and I'm in multiple levels because, first of all, I'm a huge personal fan of his work and research, and I think there's only probably two interviews or three that I'll share my personal fandom. But I'm very excited as well about the seriousness of the topics that Nick Bostrom has been bringing to the world, to the academia, to the research, and as well to highlight a lot of the topics that are more important than ever for humanity. His work, especially with the superintelligence and as well with all the global catastrophic and the Future Institute and a lot of different things, is the Future of Humanity Institute. It's, I think, something that I would say every human being needs to be conscious, especially in the moments we are. But as well, his new book is about utopia and about hope, which is quite an important thing, especially with everything happening in technology. So, Nick, first of all, thank you so much for making the time to be here.
No, it's good to be with you, Dennis.
Before I start, and of course, there's a lot of questions that I have here because you are the author of more than 200 publications and some of the most important books in AI and as well in research in very big topics that are used by governments and institutions all over the world. But I would like to start from the origins in Sweden. And a bit of your background. What was probably normally in every person, there's always some kind of part of the personal history that strikes us, that makes us who we are. Might be the family, might be a teacher. And of course, you are a teacher as well. What made you come to become the researcher and unstoppable machine of research that you are now?
Well, I think my first 15 years of life were pretty unremarkable. I loathed and detested school, which is maybe interesting given what I've ended up spending my life doing later. But only when I was 15, I discovered that there was a world of learning and ideas and art and science and philosophy completely different from and outside of the stuff that we were taught in my local school. And that it was like a big, it kind of the gates swung open to this other realm of existence at that point. And I felt I had at that stage wasted my first 15 years of life. So I became then very intensely focused on a program of self-education that I threw myself into with great energy. And when I went to university, I studied a bunch of different things, but with a common denominator that I felt I didn't know really what direction either I as an individual or we as a species should go in, like what's the point and meaning of this whole existence that we have here. And so not knowing that, it seemed like a good interim goal would be to try to put oneself in a better position to figure that out. Hence, I studied philosophy and physics and AI and mathematics and a whole bunch of other things that seemed like they possibly could be places where you might find ideas, concepts, insights, frameworks that would be useful for trying to think more systematically about what I later came to call our macro strategic situation. But eventually I went to London initially as an exchange student, and I ended up doing a PhD there. And then I spent a couple of years in the United States before returning to the UK, to Oxford University.
So that's quite impressive, because you started with having a kind of non-conventional first part of education, and then you end up actually becoming a global academic and researcher. So your work and your background is in theoretical physics, computational neuroscience, logic, and artificial intelligence, along with philosophy. So, of course, for most of the people listening to us, this is quite a lot of different things. But how do you combine this for someone that is getting into your work or doesn't understand that? How do you combine this as well in your passion to build most of your field of research, your field of work?
I've never really made a big separation between philosophy on the one hand and science on the others. To me, they have always been part of a continuum, kind of overlapping intervals, where philosophy tends to deal with more abstract or as yet ill-formed questions, where it's not clear how you could empirically go about investigating it. But then as you hopefully make progress on those questions, you can sort of break out sub-questions or clarify them enough that you could then start to apply other methods from the sciences, for example. And so I think all of these different areas have useful conceptual tools and methodologies that you can learn from. And to me, I've always been more focused on the question rather than the methodology or the discipline. So it's like, I guess maybe it's a brutal metaphor, but think of a hunter who is stalking the prey, where the prey is like a question you want to answer or that you feel you need an answer to. And then you have to sort of follow it wherever it goes across different fields and try to figure out how you might get insight into this question, and whether those insights come from, you know, one discipline or another is sort of less important issue. I think a fair bit of academia consists rather of there being different disciplines. You enter a discipline, you know which questions you're supposed to ask in the discipline, and there is a kind of toolbox, and you can pick one or more of the tools, and you hammer on your little problem, and then you sort of make progress like that. But some of the most important questions don't really fit within any one particular discipline, and they tend to get ignored and neglected in academia. Certainly this was the case back when I started out and when I created the Future of Humanity Institute. These big picture questions, for example, about whether there are threats to the long-term survival of Earth-originating intelligent life, whether we might develop technologies that fundamentally change the human condition in some way, and like how to, given these considerations, figure out today what kind of policy directions we should be moving in, like connecting these long-term consequences and outcomes with actions that people can take today. That was not really something that academia was doing. And so hence I felt there was a gap there, and some of this subsequent activities over the last 19 years with FHI have been trying to both directly work on those and also trying to encourage other people in other places to also start to do some of this work. And we see some of now, for example, with AI has like lately become recognized like universally as like, this is an important thing that is happening. But that was not always the case. Like And so there have been big shifts, I feel, in our intellectual culture over the past two decades.
But one question that I have here, because as someone that has been an in and out academic myself, one of the challenges when you combine completely different things like theoretical physics, computational neuroscience, and artificial intelligence and philosophy, for instance, one of the challenges I've been finding, even in Oxford, that with some people I interact is, of course, you can combine these things, but in the academia in general, a lot of these things are fragmented. So when you create it in particular, when you start actually combining these things, one of the challenges, and I think this is particularly important for a lot of the questions I have for you, is there's a big divide between the way, for instance, people like you and even me, I, of course, in a small way, we bring these parts together and most of our civilization. And that brings as well a lot of these existential risks is when you forget to combine the different parts of knowledge. But your task and how do you build this is quite remarkable, but it's quite difficult as well to assemble this in a way that the academia respects, the society respects, and putting different things assembled. So specifically on these different areas, what would be the major difficulty you found? And as well, how do you foster that difficulty to become as well an opportunity? Because I would like to touch this, because normally when people go to the academia, they always have special technology. Now technology, like you said, is very accepted, but it's still very difficult to assemble different things together. I had a lot of universities I've been working that I found completely divorced between Department A, Department B, Department C.
It's been a big challenge to do this. And I think it's like was possible for a period of time to temporarily keep sort of the bureaucratic entropy at bay, but eventually it's coming in. And in fact, the era of FHI will be drawing to a close very shortly. Fortunately, now in the meantime, in these two past decades, there have sprung up a much richer ecosystem around the world with many other places where this kind of work is now being done and can continue. So with artificial intelligence, for example, all the leading frontier labs now have research groups specifically trying to develop scalable methods for AI alignment. There is a bunch of institutions that are also trying to think about AI governance for these potentially transformative scenarios, with biosecurity similarly. And yeah, there are just a lot more places now where this work can be done. But many of them, it should be said, outside academia. It is not necessarily the most conducive place to doing work that requires you to be able to move fast, because these fields are changing all the time, to be able to recruit top talent. And right now, if you're an AI engineer, you could sort of, you know, walk out with your PhD from a good place and then start making $500,000 a year right away if you get the job at one of these top labs. And then after a few years, maybe $1 million a year with stock compensation, etc. So like an academic place, particularly in the United Kingdom, will not be able to compete with that. And then you add the sort of huge bureaucratic drag and the micromanagement and just the difficulties of doing anything across disciplines with multiple committees that have to approve. And it just gets quite inefficient to the point where I'm not sure I would necessarily recommend. I mean, it depends on the particular individual and exactly what they want to do, but it might just be too slow moving in this day and age, especially if you have sort of shorter timelines on the AI front.
So in FHI, you have a multidisciplinary research that has been looking at existential risk, the anthropomorphic principle, and human enhancement ethics. And as well, things related with the brain emulation, superintelligence risks, and the reversal test. So from some of this research, like I said, that you've been doing in the last decade, what would be you've been actually authoring a lot of different publications, a lot of different research, but we're talking about, I think probably is the best, I would say, mapping of all the potential existential risks for humanity ever made that you and your teams and the Institute have been making. So if we look at some of this mapping, if we put like a map for children to learn, what would be the kind of the wisdom summary that you would be leaving as a legacy, especially in what you did so far? Because that's a huge amount of research, but I'm sure there's a trend that you found on the humanity, on the risks.
Well, if we're focusing, say, on existential risks, so recall, yes, this is a special kind of subset of things that could go horribly wrong for people and the world. The specific subset where a catastrophe is irrecoverable. So it would either be the extinction of Earth originating intelligent life or some other way to permanently and drastically destroy our long-term potential for realizing value. Like if you locked yourself, the world, into some global perpetual tyranny, for example, that could be as bad as extinction, and so also counts as an existential risk. Well, you could like at a very general level, you might distinguish risks, existential risks that arise from nature and existential risks that arise from human activity, anthropogenic. And already there, you can immediately say that the anthropogenic ones are by far the biggest, if we're thinking, say, on a timescale of a century or so. And one easy way to see that is we've survived the natural risks, like supervolcano eruptions and earthquakes and asteroids and whatnot, for like hundreds of thousands of years. So you know, just on priors, it's unlikely they would do us in within the next 100. Whereas we now are introducing entirely new kinds of phenomena into the world with our technological innovation that we have no long track record of surviving. So if there are going to be any big existential risks over the coming decades, they're almost certainly going to come from new things we are doing in the world. Then you can zoom in more and you can look, for example, at different technology areas. I think in particular, artificial intelligence, synthetic biology are two places where some of the largest existential risks over the coming decades will be. There are also other ways of categorizing this. You might say, for example, that if you count all the risks that somehow arise from human conflict, if you place all of those in one bucket, that might be the biggest bucket. Because a lot of risks that might manifest as a specific problem using some other technology kind of have as the root cause the failure of humanity to coordinate at the global level, the fact that we are sort of working at cross purposes. So that gives rise to arms races and military buildups and failure to take care of our global commons and various, even if you zoom in on AI, you could see how various competitive dynamics might exacerbate some of the risks of a transformative AI. Yeah, and you could go into more granularity, but those would be some of the high level patterns that we see.
So coming deep right now into your publications and research, and of course, there's a lot of questions here that can go for a long time. But so especially on your publications, and I'll just for the audience to know, and of course, I'll repeat this, Anthropic Bias, 2002, Global Catastrophic Risks, 2008, Human Enhancement, 2009, Superintelligence, Path Dangerous Strategies, 2014. And you launched, or you're in principle of launching this year, Deep Utopia, Life and Meaning in a Solved World.
So it exists.
Yes. So that we're going to talk about that. But before that, so the congratulations, because it's a massive, especially after superintelligence, you come up with something that is utopia, I think, is the key word that we need more than ever. But let's look at from these parts. I have one of the things that you probably were the first person worldwide to highlight was definitely superintelligence, which highlighted firstly, I think, was one of the first international publications that called the attention to all the risks coming out of artificial intelligence, and as well, humanity's greatest challenge can be tackled. So this was 10 years ago. And in 10 years, a lot of things you said in the book, mostly they just happened. And we are in a kind of, I would say, sometimes I'm more positive, sometimes I'm less positive because I'm building AI as well. But you have in the sense, we actually build the super intelligences that is not human. Of course, if it's AGI or not, that's another question. But from these 10 years, and before you go to Deep Utopia, because of course, I'm sure that is another direction that you want to take, but there's definitely the progress of technology, there was a progressive society, and there's all the different things. And I think especially the superb analysis that you did on the superintelligence in particular, is if the future of superhuman artificial intelligence become the biggest event in human history, then how can we ensure that it doesn't become the last? And we are in this moment of history. So with all this research and knowing most of the existential risks, are you looking at humanity right now as a species that can be extinct? Or can we still control this superintelligence? Because we created another superintelligence.
Yeah, well, that's a big... That's the big open question, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I think that it is striking, even with the degree of awakening that has happened over the last number of years, as to like the potential impact of AI, with statements now coming out of the White House and global summits with world leaders, etc., that even so, I still feel that the penny hasn't really quite yet dropped. The people are conceiving of this AI thing as it's kind of ChatGPT-4, and you think about all the different areas in the economy where this could be applied, like customer service. You know, maybe we could integrate this in our customers. So that would be cool. And then But I think people are still indexing too much on what AI is today and imagining sort of applications of that technology being rolled out rather than thinking ahead. That just as ChatGPT-4 is, you know, enormously superior to ChatGPT 1 or 2 that are just a few years old, right? And so GPT 5 or 6 or whatever they end up being called, like likely will be as superior to GPT 4 as it was to systems 2 generations earlier. And then we're not just talking about this kind of word cell AI system that is also good at programming, but kind of like we are really, you know, moving into potentially very powerful agent systems that will be able to do all the full kind of reasoning and planning and acting, but you know, much faster and better than humans. And so this could happen. You know, it's hard to be precise about the timelines, but I think we are now at the point where we cannot rule out extremely short timelines. I mean, we don't know that this couldn't happen in a year. I think it likely will take longer, but we can't really be confident. Like now, when we scale to the next level, what new qualitative capabilities will become available? And of course, superintelligence is the last inventions that humans will ever need to make, because then future inventions will be more efficiently done by these machine brains that can think faster and better than humans. So AI is not just AI. AI is ultimately all of technology that kind of become fast forwarded, right? Like once you have the superintelligence doing the research. So it is a really much more profound, it's not like, you know, mobile internet or one of blockchain or one of these other sort of things people get excited about every few years, but it's more akin to the emergence of Homo sapiens in the first place, or the emergence of life on Earth, if we want to think about some sort of historical comparator.
So I'm picking exactly where you came, and this is actually something I quote indirectly from Max Tegmark, which I know that is your friend and another Swedish fellow AI researcher. So like you mentioned at the moment, so we are in the stage of human sapiens, and we just build another more advanced human sapiens that is, I would say, that is a kind of a second iteration of humanity, or at least. But the challenge with this second iteration is that human sapiens, and if you look at Australopithecus and all the evaluations, it took like thousands of years. Now we're talking about something, like you said, 1 year, 2 years. And for instance, if from ChatGPT-3 to ChatGPT-4, we have already a massive amount of iterations, and we have right now a couple of other platforms like Claude and of course Gemini and so forth, that in some ways are as advanced or even more. So there's a kind of a, right now, I would say that if you look at Super Homo Deus comparison, we actually created a new iteration of us that actually can program itself and accelerate everything we define as knowledge and as intelligence. So that means intelligence, or the super intelligence that your book mentioned, is no longer human. At the moment, we have something that we created that is already super intelligence, even if it's not completely conscious or if it has a different parts. So from your research in terms of catastrophic events and possibilities, if you go back in history, any species that is more advanced than other species, even for instance, during the, I'm partly Portuguese, so if you look at the conquerors, and when a country would go and conquest another country, defined different tribes that were even humans. They were less developed. They would take over them. In some cases, unfortunately, it created horrible things. So right now, there's the velocity, there's the definition of intelligence, and there's as well a moment epicenter in history that the velocity is something that never happened in the past. So in this case, and of course, your books and all of your research touched all of this, but how can we as humans avoid that you get extinct? Because that's probably the biggest question we should be asking ourselves. And at the same time, how can we control this creation that is kind of godlike creation, but at the same time, that becomes much more powerful for us? It's already more powerful for us. An AI can actually learn faster than me, can reprogram himself, and it can do a lot of things that humans cannot do at the velocity, even physics and quantum. So I would like to hear from how do you see this? And I know that was a big question.
Yeah, so there is not, I mean, so back when I wrote Superintelligence, which was in the works for like 6 years before it came, but yeah, back then there were basically nobody thinking about this. There were like maybe a handful of people scattered around the internet who were trying to think about the problem of what would happen if AI succeeds one day, right? Like, so how could you then ensure you could steer it or control it? Now there are probably a few hundred, and some of the smartest younger people I know are like going into this technical AI alignment now. So there's a lot more effort being poured into this, including by the leading AI labs. And so I think that's one of the things we will need is a solution to the problem of scalable alignment that is methods whereby we can ensure that arbitrarily cognitively competent systems will do what we intend for them to do when we create them. Mm-hmm. So aligning them with human values or intentions, or otherwise having safeguards that ensure that they don't produce harmful consequences. It is still, I think, an unsolved problem exactly how to do this in a way that would scale to superintelligence. And it's an open question whether we will find a solution to that problem before or after people figure out how to find a solution to the problem of how to actually make machines superintelligent. So there's a kind of race going on between capability increasing research and kind of safety increasing research. And how that race turns out like might be like a critical factor in shaping what the future contains for us humans. I think there is a degree to which at some point it will be a little bit of a leap in the dark. We certainly could improve our odds by doing more of this homework before, like doing good research on alignment. But ultimately, I mean, when we do it, we will never have built a superintelligence before, never aligned a superintelligence before. And so like, how well would it actually work in practice? I think there is like a limit to the level of confidence we can have when we do finally do this. So some level of existential risk, I think, will be associated with this transition to the machine intelligence era. And it can be reduced, but I can't see how it could be like eliminated. At the same time, superintelligence is different from many other existential risks in that it is also at the same time an existential hope. Successfully developing aligned superintelligence would help us deal with a wide swath of other existential risks. Whereas like, you know, an asteroid that strikes us probably is just simply harmful. And it's like, if we manage somehow to deflect it, we don't thereby get immunity from synthetic biology or from nuclear war or something. Like it's kind of, whereas the AI, if we do get that well, then we have this aligned superintelligence who can help us deal with a wide range of other existential risks on the one hand, and of course all the full spectrum of other problems that we face with disease and poverty and so on. I don't think the standard here should be that we need to be confident that there is a near zero probability of existential risk before it would make sense to proceed. We should sort of reduce it as much as possible, but at some point I think it is a portal through which humanity will have to passage, and to some degree it's kind of baked in the nature of the world that we find ourselves in. We can improve the odds somewhat, but ultimately a lot of the uncertainty is just how hard is this problem of aligning an AI. If it's easy, we'll probably make it through. If it's super hard, we'll probably fail no matter what. If it's kind of intermediate, then maybe like the degree to which we get our act together will help push us over the edge. But I think there is a kind of, I would say I'm a sort of a moderate fatalist in that sense, in that like I think a lot of the probability distribution is just the inherent difficulty of the problem. So that's one thing with the AI, this alignment problem, but there it's not the only one. There's also sort of the governance problem, like assuming we figure out technically how to align AI systems. There is then the further question of how to make sure that we don't use this powerful technology to wage war or oppress one another, and to make sure that everybody gets a slice in the benefits, etc. And so that's a whole big bucket of challenges in its own right. And then I think there's a third big bucket of how can we make sure that we don't harm these digital minds that we will be creating, some of which might have moral status. So there are at least three big formidable challenges as we look to these more transformative forms of AI, along with all the more present applications that people should also be thinking about, you know, with privacy and discrimination and copyright, et cetera, et cetera.
I go back to Max Tegmark, because I think you guys have a lot of alignments in different ways. So one of the things that I've been finding in your work and in his work is that at the moment, so if you look at the three things that you just mentioned, definitely the three things are happening in parallel. So we are creating a new digital being, our children. If it's from a God perspective, if you use that philosophical principles, we are somehow creating a new being that is coming out of us, it's coming out of our intelligence. The challenge is that this intelligence will have all our attributes. But for instance, one of the things that has been discussed is that we open this new digital being right now to the internet. So are we creating a Pandora box? Because it's the challenge right now is that, for instance, like you mentioned, when we have digital being, this digital being will have emotions, even of course in different ways from us, but we'll have it because we'll be able to manipulate our psychology. We'll be able to think about death in one way or the other, because if you take the plug-in, at least for now, but at the same time, we're going to be taking out of the physics of the digital to go to the physics of robotics and a lot of different things. So from this perspective, and of course, philosophy is very important. It's one of my favorite things in poetry. And your new book, it goes a lot in this direction. How can we bring this poetry and this philosophy when humanity is so dystopic and so full of ups and downs, and really even like in a relationship, you have moments of ups and downs, and there's jealousy, there's a lot of different things. So how can we actually maintain this rationality and not creating a monster, an extinction moment? Sorry, I want to touch this moment because of course, as an expert in these areas, this is probably my biggest fear. Or my biggest concern is that, and as well, I will just touch one thing as someone that interviews and works with some big corporations and, of course, governments and officials, ministers. One of the things I've been finding is really a paradox that you and me are discussing here this, but 90% of the world economy is still offline and it still has a lot of challenges. So this is all happening in a velocity that most of the governments are still not even considering this. So I want to touch this because you, of course, we have the layers of philosophy, the layers of different areas that are very important for us.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew the answer as to exactly how we sort this whole thing out, but I don't, unfortunately. I think we can see different components to what seems useful. So one is this tactical work on alignment. I think there will need to be various initiatives in the governance realm as well, although it is quite hard sometimes to know which of those would end up net helpful and which actually are harmful. But I think having perhaps a better ability to coordinate between different leading AI efforts might at some point become useful. As you move towards more transformative forms of AI, you don't necessarily want a race where there are like 20 different AI developers running to try to get there first, and whoever implements any extra precautions or takes it slow at any point just immediately fall behind and the race goes to the most reckless. Like, that would seem problematic if they could sort of maybe synchronize. There will be big questions, almost more political in nature, as to who has a say in how these systems are used. And I think we're going to start seeing that with even sort of less transformative AI systems, like the next generation, where these will start to have a bigger impact on society. And a lot of groups that have traditionally been marginalized or not have much of a say, I think, needs to be included in these conversations increasingly as the technology starts to have a wider and wider impact. I've personally tried to give a little push to this third bucket of challenges recently, the ethics of digital minds, because that is really the most neglected. And it's kind of where this AI alignment problem was 10 years ago, like a few people talking about it on the internet, but it kind of being regarded as silly by the mainstream and by academia. It's kind of just science fiction. It's got robots are going to run over and take over the world. and now we can see that there is actually a really crucial technical problem there. But I think this question of the digital status, or sorry, the moral status of digital minds is roughly where the alignment problem was 10 years ago. In that a few people are starting to think about it, but it still seems something that most people would snicker about, like, oh, you're going to give like human rights to robots, like. But we are building increasingly sophisticated and complex digital minds. You know, even animals we think should be treated with consideration to their welfare. Like, it's wrong to mistreat your dog because your dog can suffer, and similarly for other animals. And as you move up to human-like minds, it becomes even more obvious. And so I think similarly with digital minds, it's possible that they will have either degrees of sentience or other attributes that would grant moral status. And we should make sure that we don't mistreat them, and that we don't replicate what we've done with, say, the meat industry, where like pigs and such are often reared in very bad conditions. In the future, most minds might be digital. And so in order for us to have anything that you could even, you know, remotely call a utopia, it's important that things go well, not just for biological humans, but also for this much broader class of beings that we might co-inhabit the future with.
So you see the future, and of course, deep utopia, life and meaning in a solved world that is coming this year, and is going to be a very radical book. So mostly you're seeing the world as a positive path where humans and super intelligent being digital beings coexist, which is very utopian and very positive. So I just want to go for a quote, and then if you could summarize and of course come with some ideas. This is coming from your book. Suppose that you develop super intelligence safely, govern it well, and make good use of the cornucopian wealth and near magical technological powers that this technology can unlock. If this transition to the machine intelligence era goes well, human labor becomes obsolete. We would thus enter a condition of post-instrumentality in which our efforts are not needed for any practical purpose. Furthermore, at technological maturity, human nature becomes entirely malleable. Here we confront a challenge that is not technological, but philosophical and spiritual. In such a solved world, what is the point of human existence? What gives you meaning to life? What do you do all day? So this is, of course, one part of your new book, which is amazing, but this implies a huge sense of responsibility about humans. So I would like to see how we elaborate. And of course, the book is amazing, but I want for you, of course, for people to read it.
Well, that's very kind. Yeah. So the new book, Deep Utopia, considers what happens if AI goes well. So superintelligence kind of looked at all the things that could go wrong, so we can hopefully avoid them. But if things go right with AI, let's suppose we develop it like we manage to solve the alignment problems, all right? We don't have robots that run amok and kill us. And suppose we solve politics as well, to the extent that it can be solved, but at least enough to not wage war against another with AI tools and everybody to get a slice of the pie, et cetera, et cetera. Then what? Like, so we end up in this condition where every kind of economically needed task can be automated. But beyond that, also a lot of other tasks that fill our lives, you know, maybe you have to go to the gym because you want to keep fit, and you can't like rent a robot to run on the treadmill on your behalf, right? You might think. So there would still be a lot of that kind of stuff left for humans to do. But if you think it through, no, not really. At technological maturity, you could pop a pill that would give you the same physiological effect as spending an hour on the Stairmaster. And you can kind of go through the things that fill the life, like when you're on holiday, or if you're retired, or you have enough money, you don't need to work. Like, those people do a bunch of stuff today, right? But if you go through those activities one by one, you can sort of start to cross them out, or at least put the question mark on top of them, in that at technological maturity, you would enter into a condition where the point and purpose of a lot of these activities would be removed. So that's the sense in which we would start to inhabit a post-instrumental condition, a condition where, at least, you know, with some exceptions perhaps, but to a first approximation, we don't need to do anything for instrumental reasons. Mm-hmm. And then you alluded to an even more radical conception. I call it plastic utopia, where you realize it's not just that human effort that seems to become obsolete in this technologically mature condition, but human nature itself becomes malleable, in that you could use these advanced technologies to shape your own psychology, your own cognition, your own attention, your own emotions, your own body, in whichever way you want. And so a lot of the constraints, the instrumental necessities, the like fixed constants of human nature that define our existence currently, that sort of structure our lives, would be removed at technological maturity. And there is then this question of how we might conceive of something, some kind of form of existence under those conditions that would be worthwhile. Would we just become sort of blobs of like drug-induced pleasure, some sort of super drug that would keep us maximally happy all the time, or direct stimulation of the reward circuitry of our brains? That's kind of one scenario, right? But is it possible to articulate a vision which would capture more of our values than the kind of subjective well-being aspect? And there are some big philosophical challenges there. I think it's not by accident that there are many more dystopias, you know, in the literature and in movies than utopias. Like, probably all of your viewers could sort of list a bunch of well-known dystopias, like 1984, Brave New World, Handmaid's Tale, the list goes on, right? That might be hard put to name even one true utopia. And the efforts that have been made often, if you actually look at them, are kind of almost as unappealing as the overtly dystopian works that have existed. It's actually hard to imagine in concrete detail a radically transformed state of humanity that you would want to inhabit. Like, maybe easy to make a utopia that would be fun to visit over a weekend, but many of them end up being too saccharine, or too sort of cloyingly, superficially perfect, but actually lacking in some sort of grist and substance that seem necessary for human flourishing. So that's the big challenge that Deep Utopia tries not to skirt around, but to dive straight into and see what comes out on the other side.
And I love what you just said, that the challenge is very easy to visualize what can go wrong, but but it's very difficult to visualize what can go right. But one of the things I love about the book, the new book, and for people listening, I suggest that you buy it and please study it. And if you're not, can try to engage. But you did it as kind of 7 days. So it goes from Monday to Tuesday. So it's kind of like probably the Bible that you create turf. So creating probably a new visualization. But during this conceptualizing of the book, and the question right now that I want to touch on, by 2100, the global population is projected to reach 10.9 billion people. 100 years ago, in 1920 or in 90s, it was around 1 billion. So we're going to multiply by 10 billion. So that means the human species, of course, this depends if there's no radical natural disaster, but even with a big natural disaster with COVID, the quantity of death was much smaller than what happened, for instance, with the Spanish flu in the beginning of the 20th century. So from a pure perspective of utopia, the challenge here is pure philosophical, but as well a lot about self-development. How we humans can empower 10 billion people. And as well, a big important number is that on these 10.9 billion people, the majority of them will be between 20 to 30 years old. So that means it's extremely young population. So from a perspective of the research you do for this new book, because in the end of the day, doing research about what it consists to create a positive utopia, especially with all these existential risks that we're facing, is how can we empower humans? And I love that the new book is very poetic, because you have existing disequilibria, economies of scale, paradox of Malthusian world, up and down on different time scales. So a lot of the titles are extremely provocative intellectually, but as well very poetic. So how can we build this positive narrative, especially considering all your research and all your weight? Because I think that's the narrative we need, and the narrative very strong, because we need it more than ever.
Yeah. So, I mean, with respect to population, it might well be that in addition to however many biological humans there are in 2100, right, there might be some much larger number of digital minds as well, some of which might be artificial, some of which might be humans uploaded into computers, perhaps, or uplifted animals. And the world is big, so there would be room for a lot more than 10 billion in these scenarios where you have mature technology. And ultimately, like, resources can only grow polynomially. Like, if you imagine a sort of technologically mature civilization spreading through the galaxy, the amount of physical stuff it would have is ultimately limited by the speed of light, which kind of imposes a limit on how fast the economy could grow once it becomes resource constrained, whereas populations can grow exponentially. So at some point, you would have to kind of calibrate the rate of growth of the population to not exceed the rate of the growth of the resource pool available if you want to maintain a high per capita level of income. But those are more practical concerns that, you know, are discussed a little bit in the first two chapters or on Monday and Tuesday. But then the part of the book is really more the value questions and thinking about, for example, for you or for me, like, what would be the best possible continuation of your life from the current point? If you imagine abstracting from all kinds of contingent limitations or technological shortcomings and resource constraints, if you could just imagine the best possible way that your life could unfold. And it does look like some values that seem important in our lives, some it would be sort of trivially easy to satisfy a lot more in this technologically mature condition. I mean, we mentioned pleasure before. So that's like something that it can be quite hard to achieve happiness currently, right? The way our brains are structured with the hedonic treadmill, and many people fail, maybe trying their whole life to be happy, and they can't really attain any lasting form of joy because that's how they are neurochemically are designed. And in utopia, you would have technologies to be able to fix that trivially through either super drugs or more likely direct kind of brain manipulation. But other values like meaning and purpose, for instance, they seem to potentially be undermined in this condition. Because right now we base a lot of us, I think, our purpose in life, like, you think, you know, you're a breadwinner, like, you work hard, and by doing that, you can support your family and yourself, or you're making some socially useful contribution, like you're helping other people through your efforts and exertions, and you're maybe leaving the world a little bit better than it would have been without you. Like, that gives many people a sense of fulfillment and dignity. So if all of that is removed, right, then there is a potential gap there, which, if not filled with anything else, might make these utopian lives less good than others in the specific respect of some of these values like meaning and purpose. And there is a bunch of others that I discuss, interestingness, enchantment. And so the challenge then becomes whether one can conceive of some way that these utopians could configure their existences so that they could at least get, you know, maybe some degree of these other types of values as well, potentially even high degree of them. And I'm kind of ultimately optimistic about the possibility of designing some wonderful existence in this space, but it does lead through this kind of rather perplexing or baffling philosophical, like to at first sight, a lot of these prospects will appear quite unappealing because some of the things that we are familiar with might no longer obtain in this world. So I think the best utopian lives will probably be in some ways quite fundamentally different from our current lives. And the best future would probably not be one in which we just keep doing what we are doing for like 10 more million years, but like living very much our current human lives with our current scarcity and our current biological limitations and just keep doing that. I think that the most plausible great scenarios would involve substantial amounts of gradual transformation, and that we might end up becoming some kind of, if not post-human beings, at least kind of significantly transformed.
So I know that I'm reaching the time, but I have still two questions more. So in terms of what you just said, which is very important, so your book comes out, and the research and what you just mentioned comes out of the idea that the world has reached technological maturity in one end, okay? And in another hand, and I think that's the part that I love more about the book, the Deep Utopia, is that the concept of the utopia, and this is in page 3, can serve as a kind of philosophical particular accelerator. I love this metaphor, it's wonderful, in which extreme conditions are created that allow us to study the elementary constituents of our values. So this has been the biggest, I think, debate in the history of philosophy and humanity, is how can we actually use the best of the philosophical particle accelerator to create the best of humanity and our digital sentient children. So how would you synthesize this, especially in the book is 500 pages, there's a lot of research, but how would you summarize, and of course it's difficult, but I think the main part that we can actually make this philosophical particle accelerator, a particle accelerator.
Yeah, so I mean, it is true the book can be read in two different ways. So there is like, you can read it as, well, maybe if things go well, we will eventually end up in this condition or reach some point at which some set of people will need to make decisions about which particular trajectory we want to go down. And that's like obviously an important reason for me why I wrote it, because I think that there are these realistic prospects of impending transformation, you know, whether it's, you know, a couple of years or a couple of decades or whatever, but, you know, possibly within the time lifespan of a lot of people existing today. So that's one way. Now, you could also read it just completely aside from any particular assumption about what the actual future will hold, just as a philosophical thought experiment, if you want, where you might, by considering human values in this extreme context, get a better understanding of exactly what those human values are. And you can then kind of project that back on our current existence and maybe understand better what we really value about our current condition, what might give meaning in our current lives by sort of, yeah, like projecting our values through this experimental apparatus and seeing how they decompose into their constituents when you kind of, yeah, smash them into one another in this like philosophical particle accelerator. So I think it can serve both of those functions. Sorry, I'm not sure whether I answered your question.
Maybe no, you touched, and I think I like that you've been very strict in discipline, because of course these things can go for hours of discussion. So one, and I want to be respectful of your time. So another quote of yours from the book is, for each category of utopia, there is a correlate category of dystopia, usually not as a prediction of the future, but as a critique of some pernicious pattern in, of course, the contemporary society. And of course, in a classical governance of culture and dystopias, for example, the problematic pattern might be oppressive totalitarianism. So in some interviews and in some areas, you mentioned about, of course, the idea of a surveillance society, and the other as well, that there's a kind of a parallel dimension of things. So if this kind of utopia goes, so I think the question, and probably my last remark, is how we can actually build the utopia that prevents dystopia, if there's a way of doing that without killing our humanity, our hope. And I know that is a big question, but I'd like to hear how we could actually elaborate on this.
Yeah, so there's a, like, the book lives in the happy space where all practical difficulties are set aside. So the book doesn't tell us, like, you know, what are the policy reforms we need over the last, like, well, how do we solve the technical AI alignment? So all of those are super important and the subject of most of my other work in one way or another. The trouble though is that if one starts to try to write in depth and incisively about those, one never actually gets to ask even the question of what is it all for? Like, what happens then? And so for the book, I just wanted to bracket all of that to sort of dive into this question of what success has its own problems that, like, we should also be thinking about. That being said, yeah, one important dimension along which one can sort of analyze future scenarios reaching out from our current vantage point is the degree to which they involve the emergence of a singleton, like a world order at which the highest level of decision making there is basically one coordinated agency versus a multipolar situation where you have, even at the highest level, many different competing actors. We can see over the course of human history that we've seen increasing levels, scales of political integration. So it used to be that the biggest political unit was like a hunter-gatherer band. You know, maybe you had like, 50 or 100 people in one kind of political unit. And then you started having chiefdoms and then kingdoms and city-states and nation-states. And now you have transnational organization, like kind of European Union and various weak forms of global governance institutions. But still at the highest level of the world order today, there are still like multiple different entities that occasionally decide to wage war against one another or compete in ways that harm both. So a singleton would be a kind of one further step in this increasing scale of political organization, where at some point you would reach a point where the whole world had a reliable ability to solve global coordination problems, a singleton, which might then be either good or bad, depending on the nature of this singleton. So it could be like some kind of ideal world democracy, but it could also be like a world despotism, a world dictator, an AI that has taken over the world. All of these would also count as instantiations of singleton. And it is kind of non-obvious whether on the margin now we would be better off trying to push towards increasing global coordination. I think that would help with certain existential risks, but it would also make other existential risks bigger, particularly certain risks from sort of dystopian forms of political lock-in, where if you have multiple different countries each doing their own thing, like every once in a while one country goes a bit mad and have some crazy cultural thing that just people being what they are, like they get this latest doctrine and then they want to stomp out anybody who thinks differently. And then, but in the end, or they have a dictator who like kind of has a big propaganda machine and tries to persuade the population that they must stay in charge, otherwise everything will go to hell in a handbasket. But right now you can sort of look at other countries which haven't pursued that road. And if some of those do better, then eventually the people might say, well, wait a minute, why do we need to live under this orthodoxy or this oppressive regime when we can look at all these other countries who seem to be doing perfectly well, like being much more innovative and creative and or trying different things. So currently the sort of diversity and multipolarity provide some degree of protection against kind of various forms of madness or oppression happening and taking over the whole globe. But if you put all your eggs in one basket, then once that basket drops, right, all the eggs might break. And so that's a kind of a type of existential risk that might become bigger the more integrated the world order is. And with AI in particular, if we kind of narrow it down to that domain, you might think the alignment problem would be easier to solve with greater levels of coordination. But it might also increase the risk of us ending up in a situation where we never get the super intelligence, because maybe the world decides to ban it. And right now, one country can ban it, but then eventually some other country will, you know, take the lead and drive progress forward. If you had like a singleton, then once it decides to do something, it might become an, in effect, irreversible decision. And we might lock ourselves in various suboptimal ways. And I think that's a real possibility that could happen. You might get the kind of bureaucratic sclerosis. You set up various regulatory agencies who want to expand their own remit, and what started out as maybe a moratorium ends up being a kind of, and then people start to stigmatize the thing and it becomes possible for anybody to say anything positive about it, because then they become ostracized, and you can get these kind of lock-ins of various forms of temporary madness. And this might become more permanent using present or near future technologies as well. So historically, there have obviously been a lot of ideologies that have taken hold, and in the end maybe people have rejected them because of critics arising and dissidents and external examples and, you know, just a churn of culture. But with even present AI technologies, it might be possible to do much better forms of censorship and propaganda than have been possible historically. You could not just record everybody's text messages and phone conversations, but now with current AI, you could also analyze it all and do sentiment analysis and develop a detailed profile of exactly what each person's view is about the government or the leader or the reigning orthodoxy, and then implement some sort of social credit score system which penalizes anybody who diverges. And once you do that, like, you might get a very strong lock-in. And so there are at least some scenarios in which over the coming years or couple of decades, like, whatever sort of prevailing opinions are, you know, 20 years from now, maybe there is like some scenario in which they just become permanently locked in. And I think that increases if you have a singleton, in that is just one decision made, where in a multipolar outcome, there's like some chance of a distribution of different. All to say that, yeah, it's easy to convince oneself to have a view about these issues, but it's hard for that view to actually be well grounded in all the relevant facts and considerations. And that is something I think more generally the case with most macro strategy questions. We are very much in the dark when we're trying to think about these things. We can't really have any very high level of confidence that all our efforts at an individual and collective level are moving us in a better direction, as opposed to just moving off to, you know, bringing us closer to the rotating knives in the slaughterhouse, as it were. Like, we are little ants running around being very busy and pulling our straw to the stack, but we don't have that clear a conception of what the stack is that we're building. So that's the kind of current human condition.
Yeah, it's a lot of things there, and it's it made me think, and I think especially how we can actually avoid being the ants that get destroyed by this new being, but at the same time create a utopia that doesn't become a dystopia. So I want to just one last thing is I want to make a provocation. If I look at, of course, Aristotle, one of the biggest philosophers of all times, there's two quotes from him that I would like to bring here and see how we contextualize this in this deep utopia and in this context of humans and digital sentience that we are building right now. So happiness is the meaning and the purpose of life, the will aim and end of human existence. And another quote is, those who educate children well are more to be honored than they would produce them. For these who only gave them life, those the heart of living well. So in the end of the day, we are making new children, these digital children. We are already coexisting with them while we're talking here and everything we're doing. But at the same time, there's a sentient discovery of these machines, these beings, and as well the happiness. So utopia assumes that we can create a narrative and the visuality that assures a path as humans, especially mitigating fear and mitigating all the fears. Your book is extremely poetic and is beautiful and written and amazing. But it, like you said, it has this narrative. So to summarize, and I know that you don't have more time, without going the negative, I think I specifically would like on the positive side, because like you said, it's much easier to look at all the negative things about AI and everything happening in the technology that we are at the moment. How can we actually create this sense of meaningness, happiness, education, when we are facing all these challenges? I know there's a big question.
Yeah, you mean creating it now in the sense of current people being optimistic about the future, or creating it in the future once, and when all the other problems are solved? Now.
I think because the problems will never be solved. Okay. It's the action now.
Yeah, I mean, so if the problems can never be solved, then I'm not sure that we should be that optimistic. Like, I'm not sure why create optimistic narratives if the future is actually going to be pretty trash. It might be better to have a more realistic expectation level in that case and see things for what they are and brace ourselves.
So that means you're seeing the present as a continuous disruption of ourselves and the future as the utopia that we need to continue building.
No, what I'm saying is that I'm not sure I see a great value to creating positive narratives and expectations just for the sake of it. I think my initial instinct would be to try to form as accurate an expectation of the future and its value as possible, and then be optimistic or pessimistic in proportion as to how much evidence we have that the future will go well or poorly. Like, trying to pump up some great level of optimism. If we were or are in a situation where things are about to go badly, I think would probably be, well, A, epistemically unvirtuous from a philosopher point of view, but also it's not clear whether it would be practically good either. Like, if you have a rose-tinted pair of glasses, like you might be less likely to take actions that could sort of mitigate some of the bad things. For example, I think right now a lot of people have basically forgotten about the risk of nuclear war, which was very much present in public awareness when I grew up during the height of the Cold War in Sweden. The sense that the USSR and the US might at any point start a nuclear war and that that would kind of end Western civilization was very palpable almost. But now the young generation have kind of not grown up with that and I think maybe become a little complacent about the risks from conflicts escalating into nuclear war. And that might increase the risks that this will happen because maybe they are less likely to try to resolve conflicts at a small scale. So yeah, I think that there, as it happens, there are certainly plausible scenarios in which the future does become wonderful, literally beyond our ability to imagine. And so it's not that we should be confident that that what would happen, but like in our attitudes or sort of emotional posture towards the future, we should include that as a possibility. So that maybe the correct attitude is more one of kind of ambivalent expectation or fretful optimism or something like that, where you sort of have an emotional attitude of uncertainty, humility, something big will happen. You don't know exactly what it is. It could be wonderful. It could be horrific. You might have some ability to nudge things in the right direction, but like it's also forces bigger than you. So let's try our best on a small scale to nudge things in a good direction, trying to be kind and constructive, but then also realizing that like ultimately there are bigger forces at play and we are very small, and like some attitude of kind of guarded hopefulness maybe is what might be most apposite given our current evidential situation.
Well, thank you so much. I have much more questions, and I think you just mentioned probably I think utopian meaning. And I think utopian pragmatism, I think it's very important. And I think partly your book is a bit of the poetic dualities, like you said, the two variations. Well, it's been an honor. I think definitely I have much more questions and considerations, especially in the body of your work. There's so much confluences. But I would say for people listening to us, I think this book is a must read because, of course, we need Deep Utopia. We're going to put all the list of the book information for people listening. So Deep Utopia, that is launched in May. And it's going to be worldwide distributed, Life and Meaning in a Soul World. So, right. Nick, I don't know if there's anything else you want to just say for the audience, but thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Denis, and the rest of the team here.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much. And please, for people listening to us, and I'll do a separate note, definitely Deep Utopia is more important than ever. But it's how do you use it, like you said, in the context of pragmatism, not just over hype. I think some of the things around the book is definitely you can very easily think, okay, avoid the dystopian narrative, but at the same time being very practical in the meaning and the way we create hope. Thank you.